What's a little girl to do? She's the only sister in a family of 11 brothers. Her mom is one of four matriarchs who are mad at each other. This little girl is in a dysfunctional household. No wonder she wants to escape her family and find some friends of her own. This is the young lady we find in verse 1 of Genesis chapter 34. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. As the song says, girls just want to have fun. And Dinah just wanted some girlfriends with whom she could hang out. But innocent desires can lead us astray. The likelihood of finding the right kind of friend in the wrong kind of place isn't good. And Shechem was the wrong kind of place. Shechem was a Canaanite city full of wickedness, full of idolatry. And Dinah became prey to a perverted prince. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. The son of the king of Shechem, his name was Shechem, rapes the new girl in town. And his soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman, of course, but only after he'd raped her. I mean, the guy was a piece of work. This was a narcissist if there ever was one. Girls, don't listen to what the guy says. Listen to what the guy does. So Shechem spoke to his father, Hamor, saying, "Get me this young woman as a wife." And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Do you remember chapter 32 marked Jacob's spiritual breakthrough? He had stopped wrestling with God and he had surrendered to God's will. But now his newfound faith is tested with tragedy. And by far the most difficult tests of faith are those that attack and harm our children. And so his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob held his peace until they came. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it. And the men were grieved and very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. I mean, their kid sister had been violated. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter." Lusts would have been a more appropriate word than longs. This Shechem was a spoiled brat, and here his daddy caves into his every whim. "Please give her to him as a wife and make marriages with us. Give us your daughters to us and take our daughters to yourselves. So you shall dwell with us and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it and acquire possessions for yourselves in it." Hamor never apologizes for his son's crime. He is self-deluded. He mistakes Shechem's vile act as an open door for social and economic partnerships with Jacob's family. And then Jacob joins the scene. Shechem joins the scene. Then Shechem said to her father and her brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me ever so much dowry and gift, and I will give according to what you say to me, but give me the young woman as a wife." The rapist himself shows no remorse. Instead, he tries to cover up his rape and buy the approval of Dinah's family with a large dowry. I suppose like father, like son. But this only made Dinah's brothers angry. For the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, and spoke deceitfully because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us." Now remember, circumcision was the seal of the covenant that God had made with their grandfather, Abraham. It was a religious symbol. It was a mark of their family's identity. "But on this condition, we will consent to you." This is what they say. If you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and be gone. Now these brothers require them to be circumcised, and they give them a religious reason, but they have ulterior motives. Their plan, you see, is to avenge their sister. Verse 18. And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. And so the young man did not delay to do the thing because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. He was more honorable than all the household of his father. And I'm not sure what that means other than honorable in the sense that he was domestically driven to be circumcised. He wanted a wife. But why would the other men of the city go along with this? And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of their city and spoke with the men of their city, saying, "These men are at peace with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it. For indeed, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men consent to dwell with us, to be one people. If every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised, will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us." They suggest that unity with Jacob and his family are going to make them rich. And so it's for greed's sake that they agree to be circumcised. They get what they deserve. And all who went out of the gate of his city heeded Hamor and Shechem his son. Every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. Now it came to pass on the third day when they were in pain. I mean, these were adult males who had undergone unanesthetized surgery. I mean, they stop baseball games when a catcher feels this kind of pain. The men of Shechem are sore, man. They are incapacitated. And they become sitting ducks. For two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all of the males. It was bloody. And they killed Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. And this was probably the origin of the phrase, "Don't get caught with your pants down." Levi and Simeon did the dirty work, but then the rest of the sons of Jacob, they came upon the slain and they plundered the city. I mean, the whole family was involved because their sister had been defiled. They took their sheep, their oxen, and their donkeys, what was in the city and what was in the field and all their wealth, all their little ones and their wives, they took captive and they plundered even all that was in the houses. And notice all this brutality occurs without Jacob's knowledge or approval. It's a sign that the old man had lost control of his family. You know, we see this again when the brothers sell Joseph into slavery and they lie to Jacob about it. He has become a weak leader. He's played favorites among his siblings and he's become a stranger to his children. And it could be that this was one reason that Dinah fell into the hands of the prince. You see, she was looking for a love her father had never given her. Dad, if you have a father at home, if you have a daughter, please love that girl. Please spend time with her. For if she doesn't experience the wholesome love of a dad, she may turn to an unhealthy love in the arms of a dangerous man. Verse 30. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I." And this is a sad commentary on Jacob. All he cares about now is how his son's actions have impacted his own welfare, his own future. If he had cared as much about Dinah and her honor, then perhaps this whole incident would have never occurred. And look at the boys' response. You can't blame them. But they said, should he treat our sister like a harlot? They cared more about their sister than Jacob did his daughter. What they did was savage. It was excessive. But at least they cared enough to take action. And here's a lesson. When a father doesn't care and take courage, his kids either take off or take over. Now we come to Genesis 35. And obviously Jacob needs a revival. I mean, his faith has been far from exemplary. God had worked through a vacillating Jacob. His faith, though, had been up and down, hot and cold, on again and off again. You remember his story. After swindling his brother Esau out of his birthright, Jacob had fled to Haran. On the way, he had a dream of a ladder extending to heaven. Jacob encountered God that night, and he received the promise that God had made to his dad Isaac and to his granddad Abraham. Jacob named that place Bethel, or House of God. Jacob then spent the next 20 years building a harem and growing herds. He married two wives, Leah and Rachel. He got the bonus of two concubines. And with the four women, he sires 12 sons and a daughter. These become the founders of the future nation of Israel. Finally, Jacob returns to the land that God had promised him, and he encounters his God again. It was near a tributary to the Jordan. Jacob wrestles with God's messenger all through the night, thinking he's Esau. Finally, he realizes that he's been wrestling with God. He's been wrestling with God his whole life. And suddenly, he refuses to let go of God until he receives a blessing. This becomes Jacob's spiritual high point. Jacob surrenders to God's will, finally. And on the next day, he gets reunited with Esau. And then comes this chapter that we've just read, the slaughter at Shechem. Jacob is now dealing with the violation of a daughter, the violence of his sons, the vulnerability of being surrounded by pagans who are now out for revenge. All this had diverted Jacob's eyes from the Lord, and it had resulted in chaos and confusion within his own family. That always happens when the father gets his eyes off the Lord. Confusion takes place in his family. This man needs a new encounter with God. So in chapter 35, God sends him back to where it all began, back to Bethel. Then God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there. And make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother." God tells Jacob to make an altar. He wants to re-alter his perspective. And that's what happens at an altar. That's what happens when you once again bow your life to God. And when will we learn? This is the cure to all of our ailments. If this world has you confused and beaten down, return to the house of God. Rededicate yourself to God's will. Surrender once again, and at the altar, let him begin to re-alter your life. But notice there is some preparation that needs to be done before we come to God's altar. Verse 2. And Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone." Now, before they meet the Lord, they need to prepare themselves in three ways. They need to put away their idols. They need to purify themselves. And then they need to change their garments. And these three things also apply to you and me. First, put away your idols. You know, salvation is a free gift. We all agree with that. But you can't come to Jesus toting a big bag of other gods. You can't. Jesus will not save who he cannot govern. Whatever you love more than God, You got to put that idol away. You know what it is. Then purify yourself. Washed in Jesus' blood. Then let him cleanse your conscience and create a new identity, a new spirit within you. And then change your garments. Take that new perspective and let it color how you view yourself and life and other people. Take off your worldly attitudes. Put on Christ. And this is what Jacob's family does. Verse 4. So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands, and the earrings which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree which was by Shechem. And notice what Jacob does with all of their sin and worldliness. He buries it under a tree. It's interesting. For this is how we discard our baggage. We take it to the tree, to the cross. We take it to Calvary's tree. And at Jesus' cross, all of our sins get buried, never to be dug up again. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were all around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. God protected them. He sent a terror upon them. They all left Jacob and his family alone, all the revenge-seeking neighbors. And so Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel, or God of the house of God, because there God appeared to him when he fled from the face of his brother. Now notice Jacob doesn't get sentimental over a location. I'm afraid some Christians make this mistake. They get attached to a church building or to a holy place of some kind, as if God has spiritual hotspots, Wi-Fi zones that make prayers more effective. It would have been easy for Jacob to feel that way about Bethel. I mean, this was where he had first met God. But after his second encounter, Jacob renames this place not Bethel, but El Bethel, literally the God of the house of God. And Jacob is making a statement here. His faith is not dependent on a physical location. Jacob trusts in the God who meets, not in the meeting place. And then verse 8, now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the terebinth tree. And so the name of it was called Alon Bakuth, or tree of weeping. Now remember the influence that Rebekah had over her son, Jacob. You remember, he was a mama's boy. Rebekah was the one who had coached Jacob in his conspiracy to steal Esau's blessing and birthright. I'm sure her maid reminded Jacob of his mom. And it's not until she dies that God gives him a new name. Now, earlier, God had promised Jacob this name after their wrestling match. But here he makes it official. Often before God gives us new directives, old affiliations have to be buried. And then God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Paddan Aram and blessed him. And God said to him, your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name. And so he called his name Israel. God changes his name from Jacob, which was heel catcher, someone sneaky and conniving, to Israel, which means governed by God. And the name change points to a change of nature. See, between his two trips to Bethel, Jacob has gone from being a self-sufficient man who relied on his own schemes to being a man surrendered to God and a man who trusted in God's promises. Well, verse 11, also God said to him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. You recall Genesis 12. There we talked about the most crucial covenant in all of the Bible. You remember what it was? It was God's covenant with Abraham, the Abrahamic covenant. There God promised Abraham and his descendants a land, that they would be a nation, and that God's blessing would be upon them, or literally sod, seed, and salvation. God later passes on this covenant to Abraham's son Isaac, and now here he is reaffirming the same covenant with Abraham's grandson Jacob, who he renames Israel. And the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, I give to you, and to your descendants after you, I give this land. Today's Palestinians in the Arab world need to read those verses carefully. For the covenant that God made with Abraham also belongs to Israel and his 12 sons. Now then God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone. And he poured a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it. And again, a pile of rocks serves as a memorial or as a landmark. And we all need these kinds of landmarks or milestones in our lives. They remind us of how far God has brought us. You know, I've talked to Christians before who struggle with the assurance of their own salvation. And it's because they lack a point in time where they made or they reaffirmed a commitment. And this is why landmarks become valuable. Dates or events or experiences or your baptism. These become piles of remembrance in your life and in your memory. And here for years to come, a pile of stones marks Jacob's transformation. Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him, Bethel. And it served as a reminder to him, a landmark to him of his commitment to God. Do you have that kind of a landmark in your life? It encourages our faith. Well, verse 16. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel labored in childbirth, and she had hard labor. Ladies, you think you had hard labor. You're still around to talk about it. But now it came to pass when she was in hard labor that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, you will have this son also." And so it was as her son was, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni, or son of my sorrow. But his father called him Benjamin, or son of my right hand, a position of family honor. And so Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. I've actually been to Rachel's tomb. It's on the road going from Judah down to Bethlehem. And 2,000 years after Benjamin was born, another child gets born in Bethlehem. Jesus, too, began as son of my sorrow. He agonized on the cross, and yet later his name was changed to son of my right hand. For Jesus rose from the dead and ascended to heaven, and now God has exalted him. Today he sits in honor and in power at God's right hand. And then Israel journeyed and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. And it happened when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard about it. Boy, the dysfunction in this family continues. Bilhah was Rachel's maid. Reuben was Jacob's firstborn son. And Bilhah and Reub, they do a despicable thing. Now, they may have been close in age, but their sexual tryst here is constituted as incest. It was a sin against God and against Jacob, Reuben's father. And it cost Reub dearly. Later, Reuben will get stripped of the rights of the firstborn. See, he could have been the forefather of the Messiah. Instead, he just gets a measly sandwich named after him. Now, the sons of Jacob were 12. And here's the roll call of Israel's tribes. The sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maidservant, were Dan and Naphtali. And the sons of Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, were Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Paddan Aram. Now, it's amazing how the future of this nation, Israel, parallels the life of the man with the same name, Israel. Notice the similarities of their journeys. Both the man and the nation. Sin forces them into exile. While they're away, they yearn for home. They both develop into crafty businessmen. In exile, the Jews and Jacob gained a reputation for shrewdness. Both are preserved and prospered by God's providence. Both become wanderers throughout the world. And finally, in God's time, God returns both to the land of promise. Verse 27 tells us, then Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had dwelt. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years. And so Isaac breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, being old and full of days indeed. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. After bearing the hatchet, now Esau and Jacob come together to bury their father, the patriarch Isaac. Now, chapter 36. This is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom. Now, later in the Old Testament, we're going to read a lot about a people called the Edomites. These were the offspring of Esau. And he lists them for us. Esau took his wives. These were all pagan princesses, all idol worshipers, from the daughters of Canaan, Adah, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon and Hivite, and Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, the son of Nebaioth. I have no idea whether I pronounced those correctly, but I tried to do it confidently so you'd think so. And the rest of chapter 36 is Esau's family tree. I'm going to let you read this chapter on your own so you can stumble over the pronunciation of the names rather than laugh at me doing it. Notice, though, the end of verse 6. Esau went to a country away from the presence of his brother Jacob, for their possessions were too great for them to dwell together. And the land where they were strangers could not support them because of their livestock. So Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. Now Esau and his descendants will settle east and south of the Dead Sea. This makes the Edomites Israel's southern neighbors for years to come. And verses 15 to 19 are a list of Edom's tribal chieftains. Also mentioned in this chapter are the sons of Seir, verse 20, and the Horites, verses 29 and 30. These were the people and tribes who lived in this area prior to the Edomites. They were probably assimilated by the Edomites when they moved into the region. Now, in later years, Edom's capital becomes the rock city of Petra. Petra's treasury was used in the movie The Last Crusade. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. It's where Indiana found the Holy Grail. That's right. Other notes of interest here. King Herod, at the birth of Christ, was an Edomite. The book of Obadiah is a prophetic warning written of coming judgment upon Edom. And in verse 12, we find the name Amalek. Perhaps he was the father of the Amalekites. We'll read about them later too. And notice one other point of interest here. Verses 4, 10, and 12 of chapter 36 mention the name of a man named Eliphaz. In verse 33, you'll find the name Jobab, or perhaps Job for short. And this is why both of these names appear in the book of Job. And this is why Bible scholars believe that Job was probably the first book of the Bible written. Job's story probably occurred during the time of the patriarchs before Moses wrote Genesis. Now, chapter 37 begins the fascinating story of a man named Joseph. In fact, more than a quarter of Genesis will deal with this one man, Joseph. He'll be our subject for the remainder of the book. James Boyce once summarized Joseph's life as follows. He was loved and hated, favored and abused, tempted and trusted, exalted and abased, yet at no point in the 110-year life of Joseph did he ever seem to get his eyes off God or cease to trust him. Adversity did not harden his character. Prosperity did not ruin him. He was the same in private as in public. He was a truly great man. And over the next few weeks, we're going to talk much and learn much from the life of Joseph. Verse 1. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah. Now, obviously, Joseph was the son of Rachel. Bilhah had two sons, Dan and Naphtali. They were with him too. And the sons of Zilpah, that is Gad and Asher, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. There's no indication here that Joseph was a snitch or that he was a tattletale. His brothers, remember, were a wild bunch. And Joseph might just have been the only one that Jacob could trust. Dad needed his son's surveillance. But his role definitely didn't make his brothers fond of him. For the brothers are infuriated with him in verse 3. For Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Now, Israel really bears the blame for how the brothers treated Joseph, for he created in this family an intense sibling rivalry. Which brings up a point. If you have multiple kids, don't play favorites. Don't do it. And I understand the temptation. I have three sons and one daughter. And for some reason, oblivious to me, my wife always thought I was tougher on my gritty, grimy, gnarly, nappy, roughneck boys than I was on my sweet, precious, adorable, can-do-no-wrong princess. I just didn't see what Kathy was so concerned about. But to humor her, I've always tried to guard against any favoritism. For if you favor one child and slight another, you will unleash a divisive and damaging dynamic in your family. This was the mistake that Daddy Jacob made. And if there was ever a dad who knew better, it was Jacob. For his own father, Isaac, sadly had favored his older son, Esau, over Jake. Now Jacob repeats what he had resented. And the next line really throws a can of gasoline on the fire. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors, a special order coat. It's said of Jacob, he made the tunic, perhaps with his very own hands. Maybe he sewed it himself. It was sewn in love. One translation renders tunic of many colors as a long sleeve coat, which was a landowner's attire. You see, field hands wore short sleeves. The master was the one who wore long sleeves. And the length of a man's sleeves revealed the nature of that man's work. A commoner would roll up his sleeves to sweat, whereas the owner managed other workers. A full-length coat said to the brothers that Joseph was white-collar, while they were just blue-collar. Joseph was best of the bros. And remember, Joseph was still a teenager at the time, just 17 years old. And he was prone to the excesses of youth. You can be sure how he wore this colorful jacket played a part in inflaming his brother's jealousies. For whenever he walked out of the tent wearing that flamboyant tunic, It caused his shoulders to roll back and his chest to puff out and his stomach to suck in. This tunic made him feel special and favored. It affected Joseph. It affected Joseph the same way this jacket affected me whenever I put it on and wore it down the halls of my high school when I was a young man. My letter jacket, my high school letter jacket, 50 years later, and check that out. I wasn't sure it was going to button up, but it did. It's a little snug, but it still fits. Can you imagine? And when I put this letter jacket on the other day, wow, did it stir up memories. At Joseph's age, at 17 years old, I'd walk the halls of my alma mater in the old blue and gray. And what did I think of myself? I was cool. Man, was I cool in this jacket. You see, you don't walk in a letter jacket. You strut. You strut in a letter jacket. I mean, your achievements are sewed right across your heart, right on your chest, so everybody can see. You put on a letter jacket and it shouts that you're special, which is exactly the effect that Joseph's colorful tunic had when he put it on. And guess what it did? It made those brothers even madder. Verse 4. When his brothers saw that their father loved Joseph more than all his brothers, they hated him, and they could not speak peaceably to him. And Joseph did nothing to tamp down the tension or to diffuse the division. Rather, he tells his brothers his dreams. Now, Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. Joseph never learned that one of the keys to a happy family life is leaving a few things unsaid. Joseph keeps talking. Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. Your donut bowed down to my donut. And the brothers knew exactly what this implied. Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. How much can they hate this guy? They couldn't accept that one day they would submit to their bratty little brother. Now, Joseph's second dream had the same impact. It even enrages their dad. Verse 9, then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bow down to me. Now the whole family, father and mother and 11 brothers, all will one day bow down before Joseph. And so he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father, that's Israel, rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. For Jacob had enough discernment. Jacob knew that God's hand was on Joseph's life. He knew that one day this boy's dreams would become reality. Verse 12. Well, then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said to him, here I am. And then he said to him, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks and bring back word to me. So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron and he went to Shechem. Now, in the Old Testament, God often speaks prophetically of New Testament realities through types or analogies. It's been said typology is a species of prophecy. You may have heard it said this way: what's concealed in the old is revealed in the new. And Joseph is an excellent example of this. Joseph is going to become an amazing type for us of Jesus Christ. The name Hebron here means communion, which Joseph was enjoying with his father there in Hebron, in his father's tents, until he gets sent to Shechem. And throughout the Bible, Shechem is a city associated with sin and sorrow. And you see, this same scenario gets played out in the Gospels. God's good news begins when the Father God and his Son Jesus enjoy unbroken communion in heaven. But then the Son is sent to a Shechem, to a world of sin and sorrow. And like Joseph, Jesus comes to earth to check on his brothers, the people of Israel, the Jews. And yet, guess what? They conspire to kill him, which is what happens to Joseph in Shechem. We're going to find all kinds of parallels between Joseph and Jesus throughout this story. Well, in verse 15, Joseph arrives in Shechem. Now, a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" And so he said, "I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They have departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" Now, somehow this man had overheard the brothers say that they were headed another 15 miles northwest to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. And this name Dothan, it means two wells or two cisterns. At the time, one of them must have been dry. And this is probably where they end up tossing Joseph, in one of these wells. For 14 chapters now, we're going to journey with Joseph from the pit to Potiphar's house to the prison, finally to the palace. And his life will be guided by another P. That's providence. Providence is God's overarching will in all situations, for God is always behind the scenes altering circumstances to accomplish his purposes. We're going to see this in Joseph's life. Verse 18, "Now when they saw him afar off," and no doubt Joseph is wearing his multicolored tunic, "even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Joseph comes prancing along, but his brothers come plotting." This young man is stepping into a deep pile of trouble. He's about to fall victim to a family jealousy. You know, it's been said, envy is the art of counting the other guy's blessings rather than your own. See, God had also been good to these brothers, but they were greedy for Joseph's blessings rather than grateful for their own. As we've seen, Genesis is a battle between God and the dragon, or that is the sea monster. We find this battle at creation, you remember. We find it again when the snake tempts Eve, when Cain kills Abel, with the giants of Noah's day, at Babel with the counterfeit savior named Nimrod. See, what Satan can't stop, he then tries to spoil. And this becomes true with God's chosen family. God has chosen now Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but Satan again attacks this family with another monster, the green-eyed monster called jealousy. It was Shakespeare who coined the phrase, the green-eyed monster. One of his characters says to another, "Oh, beware of jealousy. It is the green-eyed monster which doth mock the meat it feeds on." His allusion is to cats, because cats are often green-eyed, and they tease their prey before they pounce, just like jealousy. See, we think of what we've done, what we deserve, how great we are, how we're better than that other guy. We pump ourselves up only to be brought down by pride. It's been said, envy is the back door to a pure and godly heart. Beware of envy. Here, it spoils God's chosen family. Envy can sabotage any family, even a tight-knit church family. Verse 19. Then the brothers said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." They plot to murder him. But Reuben, that is the oldest brother, he heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said to him, you know, Reuben had done enough already. let's not make the matters worse. And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver out of their hands and bring him back to his father." This was Reuben's intention all along, to return Joseph to his father. But that's not how it plays out. "For it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him." And again, that blasted coat must have been the issue. I mean, they hated that coat. It epitomized their father's favoritism. So they take it away from him. And then they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. I mean, they beat up their brother, throw him into a pit, and then they go to dinner. Some pretty callous and cutthroat fellows here. And then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices and balm and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. And here again is God's providence. It's no coincidence that at this exact moment, as they're plotting what to do with Joseph, a caravan to Egypt happens to pass by. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood?" Judah's thinking about the money. "Show me the money. How can we make some money here?" Later, another Judah, we call him Judas, will be thinking the same way. Apparently, Reuben wasn't present at the time, so Judah is in charge. Dangerous. He says, "Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened. And then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Remember, it was a Judas who sold Jesus for 30 shekels of silver. And in verse 29, Reuben comes back. "Then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes. And he returned to his brothers and said, 'The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? I mean, how can I ever return and face my father, knowing what we've actually done to his favorite son?'" And that's when they concoct a plan. "So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. And then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, 'We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?' And he recognized it and said, 'It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces.' And then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days." And what a sad plight for this old man. His grief becomes perpetual. And yet note the irony. Jacob is tricked the same way he tricked his dad. You remember he killed a goat to attach its wool to his arms, to his neck, to mimic Esau. And now his sons kill a goat and dip Joseph's coat in its blood. Jacob deceived and is now deceived by a goat. You could say his son's got his goat. The chickens came home to roost. His sin comes back to bite him. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, and he refused to be comforted. And he said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." And thus his father wept for him. And for the next 20 plus years, this old man grieves over Joseph's loss. Verse 36 shifts location to the slave markets in Egypt. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, and captain of the guard. He goes from the pit to Potiphar's house, but in between, a bizarre story gets inserted. Genesis chapter 38. You read that for next week. Read chapters 38 through 40. And there we have it. We buried Isaac, and we dipped our toe into the story of Joseph. There's much, much more to learn.